playoffs, Powerball, Penn. Wow, what a weekend, huh? And just got word that David Bowie passed. Sorry to hear that. What a great performer and songwriter that guy was. But incredible games over the weekend on the playoffs. And we've also got a Powerball worth supposedly $1.3 billion Powerball. In addition to that, Sean Penn, if you can believe it, Sean Penn was actually involved in the accidental capturing of El Chapo. El Chapo was contacting Sean Penn because he wanted a movie made about his life, and there was some young Mexican actress who he had trusted quite a bit, and so he had contacted her, and he wanted a biopic made of his life. He was very into fame. He wanted to know if Americans knew who he was, and it was communicated to him, of course, that yes, people did know who he was, and that he was I guess, you know, famous, infamous. He knew that he was, or he admitted that he was a scoundrel. So there's no doubt that they're going to go after him. Obviously, they're going to take him and try to bring him over here, extradite him, as they say. And his lawyers are already fighting against that. So. Weird playoff games over the weekend, by the way. There was a lot of controversy. At one point, a coach came on the field and sparked an incident with another player from the opposite team. That other player was sanctioned. He was penalized, and the coach's team ended up winning, which struck people, a lot of people, as wrong, of course. But that's how it played out. There were a number of mistakes that were made. You know, it seems like the professional refereeing in the NFL is getting worse. It's not really getting better. And whether you can accept that or not, there have been so many controversies this year. I don't ever remember a year with a quarter as many controversies. It's been a very strange year. So this Powerball, I mean, having grown up in Vegas, I'm not really into that type of thing myself, but even I've been thinking about going down and picking up a ticket for that. So, all right. So I'm got your clips for you from the NFL. And I'll have those in just a second. I wanted to see get a real quick clip for you from David Bowie, who's had so many incredible, incredible moments in his life. And it really changed the face of pop music. And so the kind of guy that I guess he seemed so young for so long, didn't seem like he would ever die. On the other hand, he'd had a massive heart attack about 10 years ago on stage and had kind of pulled out of the limelight for a long, long time and had just recently come back into it. Here's a little bit on David Bowie, British musician named, I think he was born Mick Jones or something, but here you go. Major Tom.
Take things struggle to understand how I'm no longer 20. I don't know. I don't know anybody else this has ever happened to. Most people, they get to 20, then they stay 20. It didn't happen for me, though. I just went on and on and on, and suddenly I'm 56. So I have to write from this unique perspective of somebody who never stopped being 20. But I went on. Isn't that weird?
David Bowie passing on, folks. Pretty sad, really. Pretty gosh dang sad. But it's kind of weird when you see somebody who's a pop idol and how they've aged. And, you know, it happens to us all. But for David Bowie, it just seems a little bit strange. All right. So we do have some. And I'll try to have a kind of more of a traditional for you, those of you who may not never even heard of the guy, you'd have to be into pop music a little bit, but I'll try to have a little bit more of a traditional send-off for him. So these NFL playoffs, I mean, really bizarre, some of the stuff going on in them, and I don't know what they can do to change the officiating. But there were a couple of games that were lost at the last minute, and one of which was the game with the Vikings. The Vikings were in a position to win the game, and they missed a kick at the very end. Strange one. Well, let's just... Let me take a break here. Oh, okay. Hold on a second. The system in lockup. Let's get a couple of these games. Let's just get a little overview of these puppies. But it was interesting football. It was somewhat agonizing. If it comes down to a last minute mistake like it did in a couple of games, that's one thing. But I mean, really, some of the mistakes by the officials were just absolutely ridiculous. And, anyway, we'll take a break, and I'll have this queued up for you. Kelly, 23-14-55, 23-14-50.
Ground control to Major Tom. Ground control to Major Tom. Take your protein pills and put your helmet on. Ground control to Major Tom.
Okay, so we've got right here your Chiefs versus Texans. Check this one out. And it was a, you know, it was a pretty good game on the books, but the actual game itself, J.J. Watts got hurt. It was a ridiculous game, and Brian Hoyer set a record for interceptions in the first half.
Alex Smith and the Chiefs taking on the Texans in the wild card playoff game down in Houston. Chiefs looking to break an 8-game postseason losing streak, trying to get a victory on the road here. Nile Davis, this is how he starts the game off, receives the kickoff, and he finds the space, goes in. 160 yards for that. Chiefs up 7-0. Time running out in the first. Brian Hoyer jumps back. Feels pressure. Fumbles. Take a closer look. You'll see his offensive lineman hits his arm. There. Causes him to fumble the ball. Kansas City, they would score a field goal on their next possession to go up 10-0. Second quarter. First and goal. Texans down 13-0. Texans called in Vince Wilfork. J.J. Watt. Watt receives a snap. Doesn't go very far. Next play, Hoyer, picked off at the 2-yard line. Hoyer's second interception of the game. Coach Bill O'Brien can't believe it. Gotta protect the ball, guys. Third quarter, under 8 to play. Keep an eye on Watt. Rushing on the bottom of the screen. Slips, falls down on the play. And you'll see his knee just gives out. Falls down. He's helped off the field, but that would be it for J.J. Watt. He would not return. You don't see that a lot with J.J. Watt. Then Jeremy Maclin, he's also down on the field. Gets hit hard. Can't be easy knowing that you can't finish up a postseason game. Obviously very emotional there. He would not return. Then later in the drive, Alex Smith finds Chris Conley in the back of the end zone for the touchdown. Kansas City running away with this one. Fourth quarter. Spencer Ware gets the handoff, flips the tackle, runs into the end zone. Kansas City wins it 30-0.
All right. So one of the things that you should take as a lesson from this, you know, the 49ers got rid of Alex Smith. Now they're going to get rid of the quarterback that they have right now, who obviously is Colin Kaepernick. Did you know the last game that Alex Smith played for them, he was, I think, 25 of 27, 2 touchdowns, no interceptions. I mean, just a great quarterback for the times we're in, and they let him go. And now their little experiment, Colin Kaepernick, although he did get into the playoffs the first couple of years, he's a bust. So, I mean, they should have never gotten rid of Alex Smith, obviously. All right, here we go. Steelers, Bengals. This game was very weird.
Oh, Andy Dalton. So A.J. McCarron getting the start, just his fourth start in his career, facing Big Ben and the Steelers. Roethlisberger into the end zone. Martavius Bryant. We're going to show you that not once, not twice. We're going to show it to you a few times because you have to see this.
What they're showing is this receiver, Martavis, he went into the end zone, caught the ball. The ball, he got turned around. The ball ended up squeezed between his calf and his thigh, and then he kind of pulled it around. But one of the most incredible catches you'll ever see for the Steelers.
I think he used every single part of his lower body at some point to bring this ball in. What a catch. Pins that ball against the back of his leg, flips out of the end zone, but he's in. Steelers, they go up 15-0. Later the third, McCarron, quick pass to Giovanni Bernard. Bernard is hit by Ryan Shazier, who picks up Bernard's fumble. Bernard down on the play. This is just one of many hits in this rainy game. They're going to make you want to look away for a second. Pittsburgh challenged that play, but the call's reversed. Shazier recovers the fumble. So here come the Steelers. Big Ben under center. Got some time, but here comes the sack by Vontaze Burfict. Roethlisberger planted right on his shoulder by Burfict. He'd be carted off the field. Fans are throwing garbage at him. But don't worry, Big Ben would be back. Here comes Jeremy Hill in the end zone. Steelers. Right now we're up 15-7, so just under 2 minutes to go. Bengals down 15-10. McCarron throws to the end zone. A.J. Green leaps up for the grab. A.J. to A.J. hookup. The Bengals, they go up 16-15. Steelers with the ball in their own 14. Landry Jones now in under center. And Burfict picks it off. Jumps the route, comes up with the big INT. Very next play. Handoff to Hill. And he fumbles. Steelers on top of the ball. They're able to recover it. Take another look. The ball comes out before Hill hits the ground. Do you hear it? It's a pulse. The Steelers have life. And look who it is. Big Ben is back on the field despite his shoulder injury. Steelers staying alive. Big Ben looking, but incomplete to Antonio Brown. But look at that hit by Burfict. A vicious hit. Personal foul, 15-yard penalty. And right after that play, Joey Porter, Steelers linebackers coach, he's on the field. You're going to see him run out. He's in the mix of Bengals players. See him right there. Pac-Man Jones comes into the screen. Lunges at Porter. Unsportsmanlike conduct for Jones. 15-yard penalty. This is going to cost them the game because Chris Boswell is able to convert on the 35-yard field goal for the win.
All right, so if you couldn't follow that, and what happened is at the very end of the game, the Bengals got not one but two 15-yard penalties. And in doing that, it brought the Steelers within field goal range. But the first one was a cheap shot hit. That basically knocked the guy out helmet to helmet. When that guy fell down, knocked out, Joey Porter, who used to play for the Steelers and now he's a coach, runs on the field to check on the player. That brings Pac-Man Jones out, that cornerback that used to always get in trouble in Vegas, shootings and stuff like that. He comes up to Joey Porter and says, basically, what are you doing here? And lunges at him. He gets another penalty. That's 30 yards in penalties, basically on the same play. So that was a game the Bengals should have won. All right, here is speaking of Seattle and Minnesota, speaking of games that should have been won, this is an unbelievable, unbelievable game, the ending of it.
Here we go. Vikings lost to the Seahawks.
And I want to say this game started, I believe it was 4 below 0. Real temperature, and because of the wind chill, it was -7 or -8, maybe -10.
2 weeks ago, 38-7 on that field. They've got the former coach, Bud Grant, there in short sleeves. Look at that.
Oh, it's a fire.
It's like the old NFL film scene from the 60s. And look at that, the old young shadow before the game. That's the thing that goes, Seahawks. Didn't get the first down, and he's bloody. And you want to be my latex salesman. Let's move on. Fourth quarter. 9-0, the Seahawks are down. And this is when everything changes. Russell Wilson. Well, in college, he was. But he ain't playing for Wisconsin, though. But Tyler, and he 35 inside the 5 wasn't ready for the snap, able to recover, and when all else fails, throw it up to left and pray. They would score a touchdown 2 plays later. Vikings now at 2, 10:45 to get Adrian Peterson. Seahawks. It was Cam Chancellor who knocked it. Peterson has had his fumbling issues. This was not one of his better games. Seahawks would kick a field goal to go up 10-9. 26 seconds left, though. Chip shot to win the game. Newman! Not even close. And when you take a look here, the Lace is out, Dan. He had made every field goal all season, 30 yards and in. Not that one. And the Seahawks survived. Folks, that's the highlight of a single point being scored on any of those plays we showed you. It was that kind of weird, wild, and woolly games, and you needed the wool, at TCF Bank Stadium in Minneapolis. Seahawks moving on now. And they're 5-2 now, and they're down 9 or more in the playoffs since the 2010 postseason.
Who knows? The Seahawks may go into the deep into the and now your final game is your final wild card game is the Green Bay Packers versus the Redskins. The Redskins were red hot coming into this game. Check it out.
Redskins hosting Aaron Rodgers and the Packers in the NFC wild card game at FedEx Field. First quarter, no score. Rodgers sacked in the end zone by Preston Smith, safety. Check out J.C. Treader. First game at left tackle, not able to protect Rodgers. David Bakhtiari inactive. Redskins up 2-0. Later in the first, Redskins up 5-0. Third and 3 from their own 43. Kirk Cousins to his best friend, Jordan Reed.
What connection Kirk Cousins to Jordan Reed this season? Surrounded by two defenders. What a snap. Heck of a play by Jordan Reed. So later in the drive, 3rd and 10.
Cousins. Let's go back to our tight end, Jordan Reed.
24-yard. Reed beats his defender, leaving him open for the touchdown. Washington up 11-0.
But Aaron Rodgers says R-E-L-A-X. Relax. Find Devontae Adams for the touchdown. Great pass. Wide.
Packers take a 17-11 lead.
Third quarter. Third and goal for the Redskins. Four receivers lined to the left. Look out for the quarter.
Redskins take the lead. Later in the third, Eddie Lacy.
Huge game from him. Break to the middle.
Inside.
Green Bay in business. Very next play. James Starks to the right. Cuts back in for the touchdown. Green Bay takes the lead 24-18.
Fourth quarter.
First and goal. Give it to Lacy. And he punches it in for a touchdown. Great blocking. The Packers defeat the Redskins 35-18 and advance to play the Arizona Cardinals in the divisional round.
That'll be a great game. No doubt that it's going to be a great game, Arizona and Green Bay. Of course, this time of year, all we expect is great games. Kelly O'Connell, 633. You're listening to AM Las Cruces on 1450 KOBE 523 1455. The great David Bowie has passed, and we salute him this week. And we're going to be right back. I'm going to tell you about this very weird story about El Chapo and Sean Penn. But at first, I'm going to fill you in on the which one am I going to do first? I think I'll give you the Powerball first. Ready for your Powerball? It's even tastier than a multivitamin. We'll be right back.
Ground control to Major Tom. 7, 6, commencing countdown, engines on. 3, 2, check ignition, 1. And may God's love be with you. Thank you.
All right, you got your Powerball of all Powerballs. Here's a little bit from the Detroit TV station.
Now to that Powerball jackpot that has everyone talking this morning.
Yeah, did you get your ticket?
Oh, of course. I didn't win.
Last night there were no winners, and right now the estimated jackpot, believe it, $1.3 billion.
Yeah, the winning numbers, take a look. Here they are, 16, 19, 32, 34, 57, and the Powerball right there, 13. Although no one won that huge jackpot, three people here in Michigan didn't win $1 million. Those tickets were purchased in London.
All right, so here is one. They're coming up to this, Lotto Mania, and check it out, what one guy wants to spend his lotto on if he wins.
We're doing it the old-fashioned way. They're just filling out bubbles here. I want to turn some of these people around and ask you guys, sir, can I ask you what your lucky numbers are?
I'm going to pick 14, 24, 2, 7, and 15.
Those are your lucky numbers. Can I tell you what? Do you know your chances of winning?
Slim to none.
Slim to none. You're right. Let me tell you, it's 1 out of 292 million. What do you think about that?
I knew it.
You knew it. your numbers are lucky, though. Am I right? Can I ask you, if you won all the money, what would you do with it?
Bunch of hookers and cocaine.
Oh, okay. That's not good. We were hoping for a different answer. That's probably not the answer that we're looking for.
You hear that? Kids, don't take this guy's his example. All right. We'll take a little break for the weather here and come back. And I'm going to tell you about this El Chapo. It's crazy. Sean Penn, I was just watching a movie with Sean Penn the night before this happened, probably the same night it happened. That movie at Close Range. Sean Penn is a superb actor, and he had that movie at Close Range, and he had the movie Falcon and the Snowman. And after that, it's like his politics got so involved with his acting that he really lost the thread. But he is a superb actor. 6:40. You're listening to AM Las Cruces on 1450 KOBE, Kelly O'Connell, 523-1450, 523-1450. We'll be right back.
Major Tom to ground control. I'm stepping through the door. And I'm hoping in a most peculiar way.
All right, it is 6:43, and I've got this weird clip, this weird story. Sean Penn meets with El Chapo. This is one of the greatest drug dealers of all time. He's the head of the Sinaloa cartel, and Sean Penn is protecting this guy, and very bizarre. Am I saying that he has a duty to turn him in? I don't know what his duty is. I know he's going from one country to another country to meet secretly with one of the world's most wanted men, a guy that's responsible for the murder of probably tens of thousands of people, and he's over there protecting him like it's part of the Geneva Convention. We have a phone call. Thanks for the call to the Kelly O'Connell Show. Who's this?
Yeah, his best role was Spicoli in Fast Times at Ridgemont High.
Yeah, well, that's an opinion. Thanks, Tom. You know, Spicoli in Fast Times at Ridgemont High was a great role, but I am telling you to see, you've got to see Falcon and the Snowman. This movie at close range was very well acted, very, very well acted. But to Fast Times at Ridgemont High, you've got the storyline. It's a true story. And at close range was a true story, too. True story of these two kids that grew up that were friends, and I think in Southern California, San Diego, and they ended up getting involved. One of them ends up getting involved with TRW or some acronym like that, part of the CIA, transmitting secrets. The other one is a drug dealer, and they end up interacting with one another. And the one guy is selling drugs. The other one is selling secrets to the Russians through Mexico. It's a very weird story, but it's extremely well acted by Sean Penn and Timothy Hutton. If you can get your hands on it, get it. It's a fantastic movie. One of my favorite movies. The role that Sean Penn played was the guy was lost. He was just paranoid from drugs. He was despicable, and he pulled it off well. Maybe he didn't like to play those kind of roles anymore, but Sean Penn, he's kind of a fantasist. I mean, he's going around the world. He's helping cure poverty and earthquakes in Haiti and in places like that. Strange guy. Was in New Orleans walking around the streets with a shotgun, loaded shotgun. But, anyway, he's always seems to be near beautiful women and in some sort of trouble. So check this out. This is from ABC News.
Sensational new twist in the saga of El Chapo, the infamous Mexican drug lord who escaped from a high security prison and was caught just days ago. But look at this. We've now learned that before the Mexican authorities tracked El Chapo down, the actor Sean Penn found him first. ABC's Matt Gutman has the story from Los Mochis, Mexico this morning. That's where El Chapo was rearrested. Matt, good morning to you.
Good morning, Dan. Apparently, El Chapo Guzman so badly wanted a biopic made of his life that he invited Hollywood actors Sean Penn and Kate Del Castillo to his mountain hideout. Now, the result was Hollywood, but no biopic for Guzman and a pair of investigations by the Mexican Attorney General's office into those actors.
This morning, that stunning new video, the first ever interview with El Chapo Guzman surfacing just a day after his capture in his home state of Sinaloa. The drug kingpin, in an interview, conducted four actors, Sean Penn and Kate Del Castillo, who who he hoped would make a biopic about his life. Filmed on a remote ranch with squawking chickens, the man credited with thousands of deaths and shipping a quarter of the narcotics into the U.S., saying, all I do is defend myself.
Para la señorita Kay del Castillo y el señor Sean Penn.
In an accompanying Rolling Stone article with that proof of interview picture, Penn describes the harrowing trip to the jungle to meet El Chapo. His charm, his son's glittery watches, and the battalion of polished bodyguards around him. On Friday, Mexican authorities said El Chapo's communications with producers and actors helped lead them to the drug lord. Mexican authorities ranking Guzman in front of the cameras now saying they may send him off again, extraditing him to the U.S. to face drug and murder charges. He's broken out of two maximum security prisons in his career, most recently last year, escaping through this tunnel built right into his prison cell. This morning, we learned how close he got to escaping again, squirting out of a gun battle at this house where five of his men were killed into the sewers. Police told us he surfaced at this intersection, and pulling up this manhole, we knew we found where he'd been.
The two of them allegedly popped out of this manhole. You can peel it back, and if you look inside, you can see that M4 with the rocket launcher. Now, they left that inside, scampered out here, carjacked a vehicle, and drove towards the highway.
The Mexican authorities finally catching El Chapo and his lieutenant on this gravel road.
They came here because it was the closest protected area to where El Chapo was arrested, about 200 yards that way. This suite is one of the furthest in the back, and they brought him inside. This is where they got his identity. They sat him down on this bed. That's where they took that famous picture.
Hours after that picture was taken, he was whisked back to that Mexican supermax prison.
Now, El Chapo could spend months in that prison as his extradition process plays out, but you could say that the Mexican authorities should be grateful to Sean Penn. After all those clandestine messages in that seven-hour tequila-fueled interview, it led them to the shootout at this house and eventually El Chapo's capture. Dan?
Stranger than fiction. Matt Gutman, thank you. For more on this, let's go to Washington and ABC's Chief Justice Correspondent Pierre Thomas. Pierre, I got to ask you.
All right, we'll take a little break here and be right back. But the question I have for you, 523-1450, is Sean Penn a hero? Is he a criminal? Or is it this totally irrelevant? Kelly O'Connell, 523-1450, AM Las Cruces, 1450, KOBE. And we'll be right back. And we are mourning the loss of David Bowie.
And the stars look very different today.
It's Kelly here, and so I've got a continuation of this interview with Sean Penn and helping with El Chapo.
Given the vast resources of the U.S. federal government, how did an actor find El Chapo before the DEA and the Mexican Army?
Well, Dan, I got one word for you, ego. Apparently, El Chapo wanted to be interviewed. He wanted his life story told, and that played a key role in Sean Penn being able to get this interview. So the primary person responsible here for this interview is El Chapo. You can't make this stuff up.
Yeah, exactly right. So let me ask you about Sean Penn, though. Could he be in any legal trouble for not alerting authorities to the whereabouts of El Chapo?
Dan, so far DOJ is not commenting, but DOJ might consider, the Justice Department might consider Sean Penn more of a working journalist in this case, and therefore would not see him as the major issue. I think the key question here is El Chapo's actions may have led to his own capture, in the sense that he gives an interview in which he acknowledges being a violent drug offender, a violent drug cartel leader. Pretty stunning, and I can guarantee you the Department of Justice will be seeking to get that into evidence if he's ever extradited.
Right, so Sean Penn's interview could become useful evidence in the legal case against El Chapo. And speaking of that, the Americans have long wanted to extradite him to face justice in our court system, and it now looks like the Mexicans are finally going to agree. Is that in essence a way of admitting on their side that they just can't keep this guy behind bars?
Breaking overnight.
Well, you know, it's unclear, but they may have decided that keeping him in jail is difficult. He's been a source of embarrassment. They got him back, and it might.
All right, so I've got another clip here from the U.S. government on the capture of El Chapo. This is White House Chief of Staff Dennis McDonough. or McDonough.
Overnight, actor Sean Penn met with El Chapo in October, the big drug trafficker, after the Mexican drug kingpin had escaped from prison. According to the New York Times, the Mexican government is now investigating Penn and others who participated in this interview. What's the Obama administration's position on this? Has the president or have you read this interview with horrific drug dealers?
Well, thanks for the opportunity to be on the show, Jake. And also what broke on Friday night is that Chapo has been rearrested, which is good. He should stay behind bars. I've not read the interview, but I have read a lot of the coverage of the interview. And one thing I will tell you is that this braggadocious action about how much heroin he sends around the world, including the United States, is maddening. We see an heroin epidemic, opioid addiction epidemic in this country. So we're going to stay on top of this with our Mexican counterparts until we get that back in the box. But El Chapo's behind bars. That's where he should stay.
Any concern about Sean Penn at all? If the Mexicans want him, will the U.S. make sure that they are able to talk to him?
Well, it poses a lot of very interesting questions, both for him and for others involved in this this so-called interview. So we'll see what happens on that. I'm not going to get ahead of it.
All right, and I have one more clip here I think I can squeeze in. But Sean Penn, actor, famous leftist actor, is involved in the capture of El Chapo accidentally, though. And here you have Marco Rubio commenting on this.
Overnight, that Sean Penn, the actor, interviewed the Mexican drug dealer El Chapo a few months back and had several follow-ups interviews. The Mexican authorities are now investigating. Do you have any problem with what he did?
Yeah, I'm not. Look, I think Sean Penn is not someone I spent a lot of time thinking about. I didn't even know he was still around. I think he made movies a long time ago or something. He interviewed El Chapo. I guess used the interview that he had in order to find him. The Mexicans did. That's fantastic. I hope they extradite El Chapo to the United States. And, you know, if one of these American actors who have benefited from the greatness of this country, who have made money from our free enterprise system, want to go fawn all over a criminal and a drug trafficker in their interviews, they have a constitutional right to do it. I find it grotesque.
Senator Rubio, thanks for joining us this morning.
Grotesque, folks. Sean Penn, you're grotesque. That's, you know what? There couldn't be anything worse. Marco Rubio said about Sean Penn is other than I thought he was already dead. All right. So anyway, just to sum up the news from the hour, we've got number one, Powerball, $1.3 billion. Go invest if you must. The playoffs, NFL playoffs, there was a blowout. There were a couple of crazy last minute losses that should have been wins for the teams, but they're moving on. And now we have El Chapo has been captured. In the next hour, I've got Jim Harbison coming on, and we're going to talk about some stuff going on with the veterans, of course. And he was kind enough to agree to come on early in the morning. Some of your other headlines, the Golden Globes, and this Revenant did pretty well. This movie kind of reminds me of A Man Called Horse, Jeremiah Johnson, and a couple of other films thrown in there, but especially the movie A Man Named Horse, where the guy's hanging by his chest from the teepee. They've got a new way of policing you, and that's to guess who's going to commit a crime before they do it. Polls, the share of Democrats reaching a record low. Democrats are fleeing the party like cockroaches from a sinking refrigerator, if I can change the metaphor there a little bit. All right, we got a lot of info on Islam I'm going to have to tell you about tomorrow. We'll take you out here. David Bowie passing, 69 years old. I didn't even know he was sick, but one of the great musical icons of his age. We're going to come back and talk to Jim Harbison about what's going on with the vets and a memorial. New memorial. We'll be right back. 6:59, Kelly O'Connell Show, AM Las Cruces, 1450 KOBE. And We've got Jim Harbison here, and so I ran into Jim at a restaurant, and we started chatting, and he said he was going to be traveling, but I asked him what he's been up to, and Jim, you said that you guys are getting ready to put together another part of the memorial.
We started construction last Monday on digging the hole to actually put the support pole in, and that'll go up sometime this week. Then the concrete has to cure for 28 days before we can actually put the helicopter up, but we're looking at that being the first week in March.
Now, could you give us a little bit of background? What helicopter?
We have a UH-1H Huey helicopter. Its tail number is 15285, and for those in the military, that means something. That's its number. It is actually a Vietnam vet itself. We have the history of this helicopter, and it flew mostly in the Tukor area. So we have this helicopter that's going to go up, and we were fortunate enough to work at a trade with the War Eagles Museum down in Santa Teresa, who originally had this one, and we swapped salvaged Apache helicopter for it, and so it's ready to go. We've got a couple fundraisers coming up where the public will have a chance to see the helicopter, I'll say two last times before it actually goes up in the air and stays up there. So
all right, so this helicopter is going to be hung from this.
It'll be suspended, actually supported on a pole. It'll be the lowest portion of the helicopter will be about 32 feet above the ground. It's in a takeoff mode, which means the tail is high in the air, and so the tip of the tail will be nearly 60 feet high.
So, and that's where the obviously the front end is dipped down and it's taking off.
Correct. Everyone thinks it's landing, but in a helicopter, when the tail is down, that's when it's landing. When it's up, it's taking off.
All right. So is this a Huey?
This is a Huey.
And if you've ever, folks, if you've ever seen the movie Apocalypse Now, these are used in it, right?
That's right. It was the main, it's the icon of the Vietnam War, the Huey helicopter.
They still use them?
The Army still has some. There's a flight squadron of them out at White Sands, but they are going to be retired at the end of this year and be replaced with Black Hawks. So there are really not many left in the active inventory, and they're being phased out all across the
world. But these were great helicopters.
They were super helicopters. They were just fantastic.
And I wonder how many of these things we had over in Vietnam at the time. We must have had tens of thousands.
You know, I don't know. I was in the first CAV, and we had several hundred just in our unit, so there were a lot.
Now, so when you guys are hanging this, what does it represent, do you think? What do you think it represents for the vets?
We're having this one painted in a medevac motif, so it will have the medevac logos on it. And for, you know, we've had some, I'll call it negative press. You know, we still have the anti-war group that's still alive and well 50 years later. They've protested that we're trying to put an instrument of death out there on the monument. And so to mitigate some of those comments, we've painted this one as a medevac. And for those of us who were there, that was our savior. We knew that if we were shot or wounded, there was a good chance within 17 minutes we would have been picked up and on an operating table in one of the field hospitals.
Wow, that's incredible.
So we could have never done that without the Huey helicopter. And the courage of the pilots who flew these was just astronomical.
So what was it about the Huey that made it so special?
Well, it was the first time that we'd used helicopters or aviation to move the troops around the battlefield. So you could pick up and deploy on a moment's notice, and you could be, many times I'd be picked up, my unit, we'd be picked up in the morning. The co-pilot would hand me a map and point it and said, this is where you're going. I might be 25, 30 miles away from where I'd been the night before. So it gave us mobility and flexibility to move around. And you could also, you know, in addition to medevac, there were gunships who fired fire suppression missions for you. And then all your supplies came in the same way. Excuse me.
How meaningful do you think this will be for the local vets?
Oh, I mean, the response has been overwhelming. We needed, middle of last month, we realized we were going to need $15,000 more to finish the project, at least get the helicopter up. And so I put together a GoFundMe package, which I've never done before, and sent out emails to all my friends. And within 6 days, we had raised $11,500.
So there's a strong support for this thing.
I wrote an editorial last November about Is Las Cruces a veteran-friendly community? When you take the government elements out of the process, it is a very, very veteran-friendly community.
What do you think that is?
Well, the Hispanics have been supporters of the military traditionally, and New Mexico in particular is a very strong group of veterans. Anytime we have a conflict, the Hispanic community seems to rally around the government and join the services.
Folks, let's take a break, and we're going to come back and give Jim a chance to clear his throat a little bit. 7:12, you're listening to AM Las Cruces on 1450 KOBE. 523-1450, we're going to come back and talk about this Huey helicopter that is being readied for hanging. UH-1H helicopter, iconic. If you ever get a chance to see the movie Apocalypse Now, those are in there. Speaking of David Bowie and Sean Penn, the movie that they were in, Falcon and the Snowman, Pat Metheny and David Bowie wrote a song for it. This is Not America. Folks, we'll be right back. 7:13. AM Las Cruces, 1450 KOBE, Kelly O'Connell.
Little peace in me will die. Oh, this is not America. Lost on bills to prove the season. Problems not to say to America. Oh, this is not a miracle.
All right, so folks, we're here with Jim Harbaugh. Jim is a patriot. He is a local resident, and he's a veteran. And Jim, how long were you in, and what did you do in the military?
I was an infantryman. So I spent 27 years in the infantry.
And what were those years? If you had to sum them up, what were those years?
1962 to 1990, and that was, you know, some tremendous. You know, I had two tours in Vietnam, and obviously that was the most traumatic part or the most meaningful part of my military service.
So your experience in the military, would you do it again?
Absolutely.
Why?
Absolutely.
Why?
You know, there are some people have a calling to serve their nation in some way, some capacity, some form of service. And from the time I was a young kid, I wanted to be in the Army. So it's just a passion I had. And, you know, there are those that are willing to see a higher calling, that think that, you know, that I might be able to protect the values we have as American and protect our way of life. And so you're willing to go out. I look at the military as an insurance policy. So I was part of that insurance.
When you got in there, between now and then, there's obviously been a big change. But although when you went in, there was a lot of protest, there was a lot of dissent and disagreement with the U.S. military being involved in Vietnam.
Actually, the protest really didn't start until 68. There was some minor protest up 67.
That's the time of the Tet Offensive?
Correct.
Yeah.
I got to Vietnam on January 18th, which happened to be my birthday in 1968. And then on January 31st, Tet broke out. All I could say is, boy, this is going to be a tough year.
Yeah, well, there is, and obviously there's nothing, no matter how many films or books you read, TV shows you watch, there's no replacement in terms of experience or the emotions than being in a war zone itself.
Yeah, you know, I think there's a lot of veterans who talk about their service. Actually, many of them from Vietnam don't talk about it, haven't talked about it. And that's one of the benefits of this memorial, that for 50 years now, the public, those people who served have been kind of in the shadows because they were afraid to talk about their service. Because
Why was that?
Well, because the reception they got when they came home from the public, you know, they were treated poorly and so forth. And their service wasn't respected. You know, they were the bad guys instead of the good guys.
Mm-hmm.
And yet what the public doesn't realize or doesn't want to acknowledge is that a great number of these soldiers who went to Vietnam and served in the military during that time frame were draftees. They had no choice. Your choice was go to jail or go to a foreign country.
Go to Canada.
Yeah. And so, you know, the three options: serve, go to jail, or, you know, defect to another country.
I always found it bizarre that the people that were anti-war tended to be, most of them, from the far left, and the Marxism that they represented, those countries were the most warlike and the most murderous countries in the history of the world.
Yeah, you know, and it's
and that's where Vietnam came from, was the conflict between Marxism and the West.
Correct. You know, and the divisions of it, just like the Vietnam War memorial we've got created, there's a big round circular map in the center of the memorial that's a map of Vietnam, and it shows both North and South Vietnam. And I hear people talk about Vietnam in the 40s, and I'm saying, excuse me, there wasn't a Vietnam in the 40s, 50s, early 50s. It was Indochina, and it was divided in 1954. And so that created North and South Vietnam, was that division in 1954. And that's how we've started our monument. We recognize Vietnam service from 1954 to the end of the war.
I have never understood, why did we end up taking the place of France when that was there? You know, they were the ones who were over there as a colonizers.
I'm not sure I can answer that. You know, I know that the option when you divided Vietnam, the northern part decided to go communist, the southern part wanted to be a democracy, and so we decided we'd support democratic forces. It was a little different political structure than what was in existence when the French, because it had been their former colony, which covered the whole peninsula. So when it was divided, and it was logical that we would support the one side that asked for our help to help them, a fledgling democracy.
Well, there's a lot of anti, I don't want to just say anti-Western thoughts out there in the society now. There's a lot of pushback on the history, and then you end up with movies like Trumbo. Dalton Trumbo was obviously a Marxist writer in Hollywood. He was a superb writer, but all of these people that ended up on the blacklist tended to be Marxists, and there's no acknowledgement today of the danger of Marxism.
You know, it's I think that's one of the things that makes our memorial unique.
It's not political.
Well, I guess that depends on your perspective, but let me put it this way. Every one of the military, there are 8 7.5 foot by 4.5 foot marble panels. One of them dedicated each of the military services, one to the National Guard, one to the Merchant Marines, which people don't realize, but 95% of everything that went to Vietnam was taken by Merchant Marine ships. Anyway, each one of these panels has got photos and a history of it. The history was written by a Vietnam veteran, not some history professor with a PhD who wants to do a political spin. The narratives on each one of these panels is written by a veteran who served there. And so I think that makes it a little different.
So, I mean, let me just interpret this a little bit. These stories are personal. They're not political.
Correct. They're correct.
All right, folks, you remember from the Apocalypse Now, the Ride of the Valkyries?
Make it loud. This is a Romeo Foxtrot. Shall we dance?
One of the most famous scenes in the history of Hollywood, the Apocalypse Now, and you've got UH-1Hs in the air with some Bell Hueys, and they are flying in formation, and the captain, which I can't remember his name, but it was played by I'm trying to remember the name of the actor, but anyway, he's kind of a crazy, he's the guy that says, I love the smell of napalm in the morning,
right.
And he switches on that music before they go on the attack. And in any event,
unfortunately, a lot of people think that that's how Vietnam was, and it really wasn't.
Of course,
it was a good movie, but it was entertaining movie, but not act.
Considered to be one of the greatest movies ever made, but of course, that was nothing like Vietnam. It wasn't orchestrated like that.
No.
And you didn't play orchestral music as you're just running, you're trying to save your own life. And
well, you know, for a Vietnam vet, when you hear the sound of a Huey, that's orchestral music to us. And there are two sounds that Vietnam vets will never forget. And one of them is the Huey, and the other is the sound of an AK-47 rifle. But you can have a vet out here now and hear a helicopter fly by, and he can tell you just from the sound whether it's a Huey or not.
Wow.
They have a distinct sound that, you know, that was our lifeblood. And that was our lifeline to everything. I spent my first tour, I was in the field. I didn't have a base camp. I dug a new foxhole and slept in the dirt every night. We got ammunition. We got food resupply.
What's a foxhole?
That's where you dig a little small hole to lay down in to keep protect yourself from incoming fire. You know, a defilade kind of position. So, you know, it could be anywhere if you're digging a regular fighting hole, then it was probably 4.5-5 feet deep. It's just a small foxhole, generally was 2 feet deep and the length of your body, so you could lay in a prone position. But, you know, the Huey was our lifeline. I didn't even know where my battalion headquarters were. I knew they're at the other end of the radio, but I couldn't have told you a physical location. And the Huey was our lifeline to everything. So that's why it is the icon for the Vietnam War. And, you know, it brought you safety. It brought you, you know, refreshment. And every once in a while, we'd get a garbage can full of cold beer that would come out. Of course, by the time it got to us, the ice was all melted. But the fact is, we all got a beer, you know, once every 6 weeks or so.
Well, it sounds like an indelible impression would be left on the mind of a young high school graduate or a person that was of age to be chosen.
Absolutely. And I was one of the oldest guys in my platoon. I was 23 years old when I went over as a lieutenant. So, you know, it made an impression on me as well. I want to go back to a comment that was made earlier about this being a veteran-friendly community. It really is. I mentioned we raised a pretty good amount of money in the 6 day period. That all came from local donations. We've had a lot of businesses step up and provide not necessarily money, but in kind support. And a couple of them, for example, the Huey has to be lifted by a crane to set on this pole. Whittaker Crane is doing that gratis. Once it's up there, then it has to be welded to the main support pole. And Weaver Welding is doing that for us, again, at no charge. Big supporters like Jack Key Motors and Citizens Bank have stepped forward to really, really support this project. And then there's been just a whole host of small donations, anywhere from $15 to $2,500 that have come from members of the community. And I have a friend that about every 90 days I get another check for $50 to the memorial. He just feels that that's a need. So the community has been super. We've had functions out there. The Combat Veterans Motorcycle Club or Association came through last month and gave us a $1,000 donation. And here we are working, installing bricks on the monument. And you hear the thunderous roar of 35 Harleys pulling up. And they're all in their leathers with a combat patch on $1,000. There are also members within the group that gave us large checks on their own in addition to that. But to see these guys, you know, I'll be 71 next week. And, you know, so these guys are my age, the Vietnam vets. And to see some of them actually break down and cry when they see the monument, it's pretty meaningful and it's pretty powerful.
Folks, we're talking to Jim Harbison and talking about the Vietnam Veterans Memorial over on Telshore. Pardon me, Road Runner, of course. And funny enough, I live right off of it. I pass it every morning when I go to come down here to the studio. But I see a lot of people down there doing I don't know, you know, what they're up to. But, I mean, some days you'll just see a few cars there. But other days it is, as far as I can see, it's cars that are parked.
Well, it's one of the most well-used parks in the city. On Saturday mornings, there's a whole bunch of youth groups or young that have soccer games and stuff on the field. On Saturday afternoons, it kind of tapers off. Sunday morning, it's quiet. People have gone to church. Sunday afternoons until late in the evening, it's absolutely packed almost every Sunday, and it's busy all week long.
And we have a phone call. Thanks for the call to the Kelly O'Connell Show. Who's this?
Kelly, this is Richard. I wanted to just say a word or two to Jim. I'm
sure.
A Cold War reserve officer that served in Korean intelligence in 58 and 59, but I just wanted to let him know I really appreciate everything he's doing about the Huey out at the Memorial Park. I couldn't be further apart from you two guys on the political spectrum, but again, I really appreciate his service in Vietnam and all the work he's doing on this memorial. So I just wanted to compliment him in that.
Richard, thank
Jim,
you very much.
There?
I am. Thank you. Appreciate your service as well. And, you know, one of the things about this memorial, it's a Vietnam-era veterans memorial. So there were a lot of people who were drafted, who enlisted in the Army during that time frame, who went to other places, for example, Korea, Germany, or stayed here in the United States. But, you know, when they were drafted, they were at the will and call of the service where they went. So the memorial is a tribute to all of those who served during that time frame.
Yeah, well, as I said, I really appreciate what you're doing. I heard Bruce Fell was working out there and fell and broke a leg or hip. Is that right?
Yes, he fell. We were doing some touch-up painting on the helicopter. He set up a ladder, but didn't secure the bottom of it and got up, and the ladder collapsed on him.
Oh, good Lord.
He fractured his leg in several places, and bottom line, he's got about 14 screws and pins in it, and he's going to be in rehab. He's home, and he's out. He's now walking with a walker, but it'll be 4 or 5 months before he's back to normal.
Well, I tried to reach him by phone, but couldn't. Next time you talk to him, tell him that Korean intelligence officer wishes him well.
I certainly will. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mike.
Thanks, Richard. Have a great day. All right, folks, we'll take a little break here. I've got Jim Harbison with the Vietnam Vets. We've got a helicopter that's going to be coming in, and it is at the Vietnam War Memorial, Las Cruces, New Mexico, on Roadrunner, and tail number 6815285, and it flew 1,000 hours of combat. We're going to come back and talk about this a little bit more. Here's a dedication to David Bowie, who passed last night. 734 AM Las Cruces, AM 1450. KOBE, Kelly O'Connell, 523-1450. We'll be back with Jim Harbison. It's 7:38, and Kelly here, and we've got Jim Harbison. I want to just tell you a little bit more about this helicopter, and then we're going to switch gears. I've got a question for Jim about an article an essay that he wrote for the paper. But first, I want to tell you more about this helicopter. It flew 1,000 hours of combat support missions in Vietnam from February 1969 to August 1970, part of the 1st Aviation Brigade, 268th Combat Aviation Battalion. It was assigned to the 134th Assault Helicopter Company and later the 61st Assault Helicopter Company. At various times during its tour of duty, this helicopter unit supported the 173rd Airborne Brigade long-range recon patrols from 173rd Company C-75th Rangers, 22nd and 23rd ARVN divisions, and their MACV advisors, MACV Intelligence, People Sniffer and Sniffer missions, 5th Special Forces, A-Team Special Forces, Mike Force units, 4th Infantry Division, 52nd Artillery Brigade, 6 regiments of the 2 Korean divisions in the area, 28th through 33rd ROK regiments, and 1st Air Cavalry Division. So, anyway, an illustrious career for this helicopter.
Yeah, we're pretty excited about it. You know, it's another Vietnam vet, a legitimate Vietnam vet. And we've done everything we can to restore this. There were some, you know, it flew after Vietnam service. It flew up through 1990. And so there were modifications that were put on it that don't represent what was in Vietnam. And we've taken all of those off to make this look just like it would have looked in Vietnam and have painted it the same.
Could it fly right now?
No.
Oh, okay.
No, you had a bunch of people like me, all volunteers who were not aviation mechanics who put this thing together. I wouldn't even dream of it.
Okay. All right.
The other thing, it doesn't have an engine.
How comfortable were these things to fly in?
Well, you know, if you talk about the movie Apocalypse Now, you see the soldiers sitting on the edge with their feet dangling out, hanging out. There is no safety strap. There was no seat belts. That was exactly how we flew.
And like being on a bus.
It's what?
Like being on a bus, a city bus.
Yeah,
except you're up in the air. Yeah. Well, and not to denigrate the care that these things were made with, but I've got in my hand a Vietnam War Memorial thank you, welcome home coin, and I really appreciate this, Jim. Las Cruces, New Mexico, Veterans Park on the back, 2014. I'm going to carry this.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
And I do appreciate it very much. I don't know. I've always been, I never went to the military. I'm sure it would have done me a lot of good, but I've always had a soft spot for the military. And this idea, the American idea of patriotism that is different than any other country.
That's right. You know, and I think that's what distinguishes us from other nations, and that's why our military has the strength and the might that it has.
Well, there's something to understand. If you're raised in Germany, you have a German mindset, you have a commitment to Germany. Maybe Germany's a bad choice because of the last couple of world wars, but if you're raised in a country, that is your country, and you're there because of the people before you, and those people before them were there back to time immemorial. In America, we have a different idea. We have a commitment to an idea, to an ethos, to a way of life, an approach to politics and law and human rights and everything that makes us so different. And so when you say you're American and you're fighting for America, it is something that you can truly commit yourself to.
Well, absolutely. And, you know, it's a value orientation for most of us. And, you know, again, we have people who say serving in the military is a pathway to citizenship for me. And so there's a lot of non-citizens who serve in our military who are the most loyal, dedicated, and fearless soldiers you'll find. I mean, they're willing to give their life for this country.
All right. Speaking of this topic, you had written an article that I read a couple, and I read it and I reread it, The Puppet Master, that had to do with a local character who runs elections. But what I wanted to get at there is this idea that we're, as a city, we're going to be, in a county, we're going to be run by characters that are pulled in, who grew up somewhere else, whose loyalties and experience are somewhere else, who don't know really anything about Doñana. And because there's a political master in town, this person is going to pull in these individuals to run. They're like racehorses that are brought in from a farm across the United States. I find it bizarre. I find it troubling that these people could get local support. Where's our local leaders?
Well, you know, I think most people are aware that I retired from editorial writing the end of the year. My last editorial was on Christmas Eve. I've been running for 5 years, and my goal was to try to alert the public to these kinds of issues, to say, wait a minute, you know, you're not controlling what goes on in your city. There's someone else here who, you know, I'll call a puppet master, who pulls the strings for everybody and gets people from unknowns who walk into our city from outside areas, and all of a sudden they get all the political support. And the current theme here is we're trying to go for public funded elections. We want the public to pay for that, you know, the taxpayers to pay for it. My attitude is, if you want to run for office, you need to go out and get your support. I shouldn't have to demand or expect the public to support me unwillingly, and that's what my mind public support is. But you get guys like Don Kurtz is the puppet master. He's the one that is the progressive leader. You can go online and look at the minutes from the Progressive Voter Alliance and find out what goes on. But Don is the guy in the background, and he's the one that you know, kind of controls everything. And so we have these selective people who come in that get his support, and goes from there.
Well, let's come back and talk about the ideology that drives this. Kelly O'Connell, I'm with here with Jim Harbison. He's going to be leaving, but before he leaves, he's going to be taking a little trip. He's helped to organize the placement of a 1HUH Huey helicopter. There's a lot of excitement out there. We'll be back, though, and talk a little bit about one of the articles that he wrote before he retired as an editorialist at the Sun News. It's 7:44. You're listening to AM Las Cruces on 1450 KOBE, 523-1450. All right. So I just want to mention that there is going to be a car show. There's going to be a car show at the Vietnam War Memorial, 27th of February, 2016, 27th of February, Allen Theater, parking lot, 2811 North Telshore, Las Cruces, and it's open to the public. All cars welcome, $25 entry fee in advance, 30-day of show, vendors $25. So anyway, what is this about, Jim?
Well, this is the final fundraiser. We're hoping it'll be our final fundraiser to get everything necessary to finish the monument. It'll also be the last time the public can actually see the helicopter up close, because the following week we're going to mount it on the pole. So it gives the public a chance to see it before it goes in the air one last time. And we're hoping that we can secure enough funds. There's a project that the final, we'll get the helicopter mounted, but then we have to plant palm trees behind it, and we can't do that until May because of the freeze. So,
all right. So we were talking about the idea that somebody comes into our small town, and well, let's face it, we're not the most sophisticated town in history. We're a small town. We are essentially a farming community that added on a university, and it's a great place to live and everything. But you know, we're not New York City. We're not Chicago. People coming in from the outside, do people even notice that some of these candidates are not from here?
You know, that's the thing that baffles me the most. And I've been criticized because I came here originally from California. I spent 4 years in Arizona, then I moved to New Mexico. I moved here because I did not want to be in another California. You know, Las Cruces has, and New Mexico itself has, a unique culture. And so that's what I wanted to enjoy. And so we let all these people come in. We've got former city councilors who've been retired, who came from professorships at the University of Michigan and others like that, who come in with progressive ideas that are, I think, foreign to our culture here. And yet we don't seem to notice. And you get the puppet masters who come in and control all the politics. We have people who show up here who've never been involved in our community, have no idea what goes on, and all of a sudden we've got them elected into office, you know, and you think, how does this happen?
How does somebody that doesn't have a dog in the fight, doesn't have a skin in the game, come in and not just take part, but make decisions that will control the parameters of government and decision making for years or decades to come?
Well, you know, I'm very critical of the puppet master, but I'll give him credit. He is very well organized, and he organizes the groups to do that. It's kind of like the Democrats are going to support Hillary Clinton no matter what.
I want to just throw one thing out there that I've kind of been working on in my mind. We believe in representative government. It's the whole theory that the United States was based on. Your electors, the people that you elect, represent your opinion.
That's the theory.
Yeah, and that's in the Declaration. The Declaration is a radical enough document to say that once that stops happening, you're allowed to, or expected to, or you have the duty to throw the bums out of office or overturn the government if it's no longer functional. I believe that's why Donald Trump is very popular these days, is he's giving mouth to sentiment of giant numbers of people who are dissatisfied. But let me just put a cap on this by saying, when I see somebody in the local area doing things, making decisions that are not representative of the people's will, like the busing situation,
absolutely,
and the taxing situation, it makes me think of what's happening at the highest levels, where people are making decisions as if they are prophets or as if they are gods, and one vote represents the entire United States because they're stupid, or we're stupid, and the rest, you know, the leadership is a genius and everybody else is dumb. We'll come right back and finish up with these ideas. 752 AM Las Cruces, 1450 KOBE, 523 1450 Kelly O'Connell. Vox Populi, Vox Dei, the voice of the people is the voice of God. We'll be right back.
Melting from the inside, Falcon sirens to the ground.
Well, we're just finishing up here. I'm looking at an article that that Jim had pointed out to me on the break. Gallup share of Democrats reaches record low. I actually read this article earlier, but he said take a look at it. The share of Americans identifying as Democrats dropped to a record low in 2015, according to Gallup results published Monday. Overall, 42% over the course of the past year identified as independents. That's stunning. A slight drop from 43% independents in 2014, while Democrats maintained a small advantage over Republicans, 29% to 26%, the shares the lowest in history. And one of the things to remember, when you've got people standing up claiming to represent you or trying to represent you, or at least taking the position of somebody who would represent you, the number of conservatives in this country versus true liberals, 2-1. There's twice as many conservatives in this country as there are liberals, true liberals, which is why you've got to cook the books. You've got to come up with a different way to control people, like bringing in ringers from outside to come and run and uphold the agenda.
Yeah, you know, and the example on the buses here is great. The voters said, no, we do not want bus service. We don't want taxes. And so the county turns around and allocates $700,000 to do that. And if you read the paper this past week, you see where they've just purchased 5 new buses to support this thing that the taxpayers said we don't want to do. Who are these people representing? How did they get into power?
Well, and I'll bring it back again. There is nothing more holy to John Locke, who was the inspiration for, to a large extent, the Declaration and the Constitution. His idea was constitutionalism. And he said there's nothing more important than representative government, to represent the voice of the people.
Yeah, and we don't have that. We have a group of people who are representing a philosophy, but not the will of the people in this community. It's their personal philosophy.
And what more to the point, when we have tried liberalism, and I'm talking about far leftism, Marxist, socialist ideas, they always fail. They always fail because it's not about efficient or ethical leadership. It is about power.
Right. You know, that's what kind of mind-boggling for me, to see what goes on in this community.
It is. So you're done writing, but you're calling people out to get involved in their own community.
Absolutely. You know,
how can they do that?
First of all, you got to get involved in the political process. You've got to start. We have people who work. I have good conservative friends who said I didn't vote because I was too busy. You got to take time to make sure, because it's your fate. It's the fate of your family and your future if you don't take time, and they've got to get out, get involved, and at least understand the issues.
All right. Contact information for the Vietnam people.
They can call me at 928-234-1210. And
one more time.
928-234-1210. And we'll go from there.
Thanks for coming on, Jim. Let's get you back on soon, and after that, we get this bird hung up there, okay?
All right. Thanks, Kelly.
Thanks,
appreciate it.
Thanks for listening, folks. You've been listening to AM Las Cruces, 1450 KOBE. We'll pick it up again in 22 hours. Kelly O'Connell, have a great day. Ciao.
A little piece of you. A little piece in me. Never come.